If it is easier for them to run west than east, they run west. But about 10% of them are not from the border areas at all. They are white volunteers who have deliberately crossed over to join our fight. Some have come from as far as the East Coast, whole families as well as young men, who made their decision as soon as it became apparent to the country that our revolution has indeed established a foothold here. The next diary entry is dated July 24th. Boy, I'm really becoming a jack of all trades. I just got back to headquarters from a repair trip to the big switching station outside Santa Barbara. It's been acting up, knocking out our electrical power here every day or so, and I had to figure out what was wrong and get a repair crew to fix it. I'll certainly be glad when we get the civilian population here organized so that the people who are supposed to keep the utilities running are back on the job again. But we must do first things first, and that means reestablishing public order and ensuring an adequate food supply. We still don't have order, but we're now bringing almost enough food into the metropolitan area to keep the people from starving. I got some insight into how we're managing that during the Santa Barbara trip. In the countryside, I passed literally hundreds of organized groups of white youngsters, some working in the orchards and fruit groves, others marching along the road singing, with fruit baskets slung across their shoulders. They all looked tanned and happy and healthy. Quite a difference from the hunger and the rioting in the cities. I had my driver stop as we came abreast of a group of about 20 young girls, all wearing heavy work gloves and miscellaneously dressed in shorts and overalls. Their leader was a freckled 15-year-old with pigtails, who happily identified her group as the 128th Los Angeles Food Brigade. They had just finished 5 hours of fruit picking and were headed for lunch at their tent camp down the road. Well, I thought to myself, this is hardly a brigade, but obviously a lot more organizing of the civilian population has been going on than I've been aware of. I knew the girl was too young to be a member of the organization, and it soon developed she was totally innocent of any political understanding whatever. All she knew was that things back in the city are frightening and unpleasant, and so when the nice lady with the armband at the emergency food distribution center had talked to her and her parents and told them that youngsters who volunteered for farm work would be looked after and well fed, they had agreed she should go. That was a week ago, and yesterday she had been appointed the leader of her group of girls. I asked her what she thinks about her work. She said it is hard, but she knows it is important for her and her girls to pick as much fruit as possible, so their parents and friends back in the city will be able to eat. The adults at the camp have explained to them what an important responsibility they have. Had they also been told about the significance of the revolution? No, she doesn't know anything about that, just that the Chicano farm workers have left, and now the white people will have to do all their work. She thinks that is probably a good idea. Other than that, all that the girls have been taught is how to do their particular job, and the work songs and the hygiene lectures in the evening around the campfire. Well, that's not a bad beginning for 12 to 15-year-olds. There will be time for their further education later. If only the adults were as cooperative as the kids. The girls did have one complaint, their food. There was plenty of it, but it was all fruits and vegetables. No meat, no milk, not even any bread. Obviously, the people who are organizing the food brigades have a few logistic problems yet to work out, too. We swapped the girls half a case of canned sardines and some boxes of soda crackers we had in the car in return for a basket of apples, and both sides felt they had gotten a good deal. Coming through the mountains just north of Los Angeles, we encountered a long column of marchers, heavily guarded by GIs and organization personnel. As we drove slowly past, I observed the prisoners closely, trying to decide what they were. They didn't seem to be blacks or Chicanos, and yet only a few of them appeared to be whites. Many of the faces were distinctly Jewish, while others had features or hair suggesting a Negroid taint. The head of the column turned off the main roadway into a little-used ranger trail, which disappeared into a boulder-strewn canyon, while the tail stretched for several miles back toward the city. There may have been as many as 50,000 marchers, representing all ages and both sexes, just in the portion of the column we passed. Back at headquarters, I inquired about the strange column. No one was sure, although the consensus was that they were the Jews and the mixed breeds of too light a hue to be included with the evacuees who were sent east. I remember now something which puzzled me a few days ago, the separation of the very light blacks, the almost whites, the octoroons and quadroons, the unclassifiable mongrels from various Asian and southern climes, from the others during the concentration and evacuation operations. And I think I now understand. The clearly distinguishable non-whites are the ones we want to increase the racial pressure on the whites outside California. The presence of more almost white mongrels would merely confuse the issue, and there is always the danger that they will later pass as white. Better to deal with them now, as soon as we get our hands on them. I have a suspicion their trip into that canyon north of here will be a one-way affair. But obviously there's still a lot of sifting out to do. We have cleared the all-black and all-Chicano areas and certain all-Jewish neighborhoods, but there are still areas comprising nearly half the urban territory under our control where utter chaos prevails. Jews in these areas, working with reactionary elements among the whites, are becoming more brazen by the day. There is nearly continuous demonstrating and rioting going on in the worst sections, and the Jews are using leaflets and other means to maintain the general unrest in other sections. Since Friday, four of our people have been killed by snipers. Something must be done soon. The next diary entry is dated July 25th. A very pleasant contrast today with most of my work of late. I spent the day interviewing some of the volunteers who have crossed into our area since July 4th, trying to pick 100 or so for a special problem-solving group which will begin doing in a regular and systematic way the sort of engineering and logistic chores I and my crew have been stuck with till now. The people I talked to had been pre-screened before they got to me, and they all have an engineering or industrial management background. There are about 300 men, plus 100 or so wives and children, which is an indication of the really substantial flow of new blood into our area. I don't know what the total is up to now, but I do know that the organization has increased its strength in California several times over in the last 3 weeks, and we are taking as members only a small fraction of the new volunteers. The great majority have either been organized into labor brigades, primarily for farm work, or in the case of most of the males of military age, put into army uniforms and given rifles we've salvaged from one of the bombed-out National Guard armories. In the latter way, we are gradually increasing the overall reliability, if not the proficiency, of the military force under our control. Many of these instant soldiers have had little or no military training, and we haven't had a chance yet to give them any of the ideological preparation which the new organization members are receiving. Yet they are clearly more sympathetic to our cause on the average than the regular GIs. We are integrating them into the regular units as rapidly as we can. I queried the people I saw today about their present living arrangements and family situations, as well as about their training and work experience. Nearly all of them have been assigned to a block of recently vacated housing in a former black area, just south of Los Angeles proper. The organization has set up a new unit headquarters in a small apartment building there, and that's where the interviews took place. There were very few complaints from the people I talked to, although they all mentioned the extraordinarily filthy condition of the buildings into which they have moved. Some of the apartment units are so saturated with filth, they are simply not habitable. Everyone, however, has pitched in cheerfully, and the disinfecting, scrubbing, and repainting effort has made a remarkable transformation in just a couple of days. I made a brief inspection tour, and it was heartwarming to see pretty white children playing quietly where previously hordes of screaming young blacks had swarmed. A group of about 24 parents were still working on the grounds around the apartments. They have collected a small mountain of litter, beer cans, cigarette wrappers, empty TV dinner cartons, demolished furniture, and rusted out appliances. Two women have marked off a sizable area of barren, thoroughly trampled lawn with stakes and string, and are spading up the earth for a community vegetable garden. In windows which had previously known only torn paper shades, bright curtains, improvised from bed sheets and home dyed, I imagine, have gone up. Fresh flowers are on sills formerly occupied only by empty liquor bottles. Most of these people arrived here with little more than the clothes on their backs, having left everything behind and risked their lives in order to be with us. It's a shame we are unable to do more for them now, but they're the type who are pretty well able to do for themselves. One of the first volunteers I picked this morning was a man to find a suitable truck somewhere and use it regularly for hauling refuse away from the new settlement and bringing in food each day from the nearest distribution point, which is about 6 miles away. He will be responsible for his own mechanical maintenance and for finding gasoline wherever he can, until we have time to set up a new fuel distribution system. He is a 60-year-old who formerly owned his own plastics factory in Indiana, but he is happy to be a garbage man here. By the time we get the overall civilian situation whipped into shape, the average population density in our part of California will be a little less than half what it was a month ago. There'll be the greatest plenty of housing for new people coming in, and we'll probably level about half the residential and commercial areas in Los Angeles County, plant trees, and make parkland of them. That lies in the future, though. And for now, our aim is simply to settle the new people temporarily in areas well separated from those we haven't pacified and weeded yet. But even the tiny beginning we have already made fills me with joy and pride. What a miracle it is to walk streets which only a few weeks ago were filled with non-whites lounging at every street corner and in every doorway, and to see only white faces, clean, happy, enthusiastic white faces, determined and hopeful for the future. No sacrifice is too great to successfully complete our revolution and secure that future for them. And for the girls of the 128th Los Angeles Food Brigade, and for millions of others like them throughout our land. The next diary entry is dated August 1st, 1993. Today has been the day of the rope, a grim and bloody day, but an unavoidable one. Tonight, for the first time in weeks, it is quiet and totally peaceful throughout all of Southern California. But the night is filled with silent horrors. From tens of thousands of lampposts, power poles, and trees throughout this vast metropolitan area, the grisly forms hang. In the lighted areas, one sees them everywhere. Even the street signs at intersections have been pressed into service, and at practically every street corner I passed this evening on my way to headquarters, there was a dangling corpse, four at every intersection. Hanging from a single overpass, only about a mile from here, is a group of about 30, each with an identical placard around his neck bearing the printed legend, "I betrayed my race." Two or three of that group had been decked out in academic robes before they were strung up, and the whole batch are apparently faculty members from the nearby UCLA campus. In the areas to which we have not yet restored electrical power, the corpses are less visible, but the feeling of horror in the air there is even worse than in the lighted areas. I had to walk through a two-block-long, unlighted residential section between headquarters and my living quarters after our unit meeting tonight. In the middle of one of the unlighted blocks, I saw what appeared to be a person standing on the sidewalk directly in front of me. As I approached the silent figure, whose features were hidden in the shadow of a large tree overhanging the sidewalk, it remained motionless, blocking my way. Feeling some apprehension, I slipped my pistol out of its holster. Then, when I was within a dozen feet of the figure, which had been facing away from me, it began turning slowly toward me. There was something indescribably eerie about the movement, and I stopped in my tracks as the figure continued to turn. A slight breeze rustled the foliage overhead, and suddenly a beam of moonlight broke through the leaves and fell directly on the silently turning shape before me. The first thing I saw in the moonlight was the placard with its legend in large block letters, "I defiled my race." Above the placard leered the horribly bloated, purplish face of a young woman, her eyes wide open and bulging, her mouth agape. Finally, I could make out the thin, vertical line of rope disappearing into the branches above. Apparently, the rope had slipped a bit, or the branch to which it was tied had sagged, until the woman's feet were resting on the pavement, giving the uncanny appearance of a corpse standing upright of its own volition. I shuddered and quickly went on my way. There are many thousands of hanging female corpses like that in the city tonight, all wearing identical placards around their necks. They are the white women who were married to or living with blacks, with Jews, or with other non-white males. There are also a number of men wearing the "I defiled my race" placard, but the women easily outnumber them 7 or 8 to 1. On the other hand, about 90% of the corpses with the "I betrayed my race" placards are men, and overall the sexes seem to be roughly balanced. Those wearing the latter placards are the politicians, the lawyers, the businessmen, the TV newscasters, the newspaper reporters and editors, the judges, the teachers, the school officials, the civic leaders, the bureaucrats, the preachers, and all the others who, for reasons of career or status or votes or whatever, helped promote or implement the system's racial program. The system had already paid them their 30 pieces of silver. Today, we paid them. It started at 3 o'clock this morning. Yesterday was an especially bad day of rioting, with the Jews using transistorized megaphones to whip up the crowds and egg them into throwing stones and bottles at our troops. They were chanting, "Racism must go," and "Equality forever," and other slogans the Jews had taught them. It reminded me of the mass demonstrations of the Vietnam era. The Jews have a knack for things like that. But by 3 o'clock this afternoon, the crowds had long since finished their orgy of violence and chanting and were in bed, all except a few groups of diehards who had rigged up loudspeakers and were blaring system radio broadcasts out over the surrounding neighborhoods, broadcasts which alternated between screaming rock music and appeals for brotherhood. Squads of our troops with synchronized watches suddenly appeared in 1,000 blocks at once in 50 different residential neighborhoods, and every squad leader had a long list of names and addresses. The blaring music suddenly stopped and was replaced by the sound of thousands of doors splintering as booted feet kicked them open. It was like the gun raids of 4 years ago, only in reverse, and the outcome was both more drastic and more permanent for those raided. One of two things happened to those the troops dragged out onto the streets. If they were non-whites, and that included all the Jews and everyone who even looked like he had a bit of non-white ancestry, they were shoved into hastily formed columns and started on their no-return march to the canyon in the foothills north of the city. The slightest resistance, any attempted backtalk, or any lagging brought a swift bullet. The whites, on the other hand, were in nearly all cases hanged on the spot. One of the two types of pre-printed placards was hung on the victim's chest. His hands were quickly taped behind his back. A rope was thrown over a convenient limb or signpost, with the other end knotted around his neck, and he was then hauled clear of the ground with no further ado and left dancing on air while the soldiers went to the next name on their list. The hangings and the formation of the death columns went on for about 10 hours without interruption. When the troops finished their grim work early this afternoon and began returning to their barracks, the Los Angeles area was utterly and completely pacified. The residents of neighborhoods in which we could venture safely only in a tank yesterday were trembling behind closed doors today, afraid even to be seen peering through the crack in drawn drapes. Throughout the morning, there was no organized or large-scale opposition to our troops, and by this afternoon, even the desire for opposition had evaporated. I and my men were in the thick of things all day, mostly handling logistics. When the execution squads began running out of rope, we stripped several miles of wire from power poles to use in its place. We also rounded up hundreds of ladders. And we were the ones who pasted up the proclamations from Revolutionary Command in every block, warning all citizens that henceforth any act of looting, rioting, or sabotage, or any failure to obey the command of a soldier will result in the summary execution of the offender. The proclamations also carry a similar warning for anyone who knowingly harbors a Jew or other non-white, or who willfully provides false information to, or withholds information from, our police units. Finally, they list the reporting point in each neighborhood to which every person, at a time and date depending upon the position of his name in the alphabet, is to report for registration and assignment to a work unit. I nearly got into a shooting fight with a company commander near City Hall this morning about 9 o'clock. That's where we were taking all the big shots to be hanged. The well-known politicians, a number of prominent Hollywood actors and actresses, and several TV personalities. If we had strung them up in front of their homes like everyone else, only a few people would have seen them. And we wanted their example to be instructive to a much wider audience. For the same reason, many of the priests on our lists were taken to one of three large churches where we had TV crews set up to broadcast their executions. The trouble was that many of the big shots were arriving at City Hall already more dead than alive. The troops on the transport trucks were really giving them a working over. One famous actress, a notorious race mixer who had starred in several large-budget interracial love epics, had lost most of her hair, an eye, and several teeth, not to mention all her clothes, before the rope was put around her neck. She was a bruised and bloody mess. I wouldn't have known who she was if I hadn't asked. What, I wondered, was the point in publicly hanging her if the public couldn't recognize her and draw the proper inferences between her former behavior and her punishment? I was drawn to a commotion near one of the trucks which had just arrived. A grossly fat old man, whom I immediately recognized as the federal judge who had handed down some of the system's most outrageous rulings in recent years, including the one confirming the power of arrest granted by the Human Relations Councils to their black deputies, was resisting the efforts of the troops to pull off his pajamas and dress him in his judicial robe. One of the soldiers knocked him down, and then four others began kicking him and repeatedly slamming him in the face, stomach, and groin with their rifle butts. He was unconscious and perhaps already dead when the rope was knotted around his neck and his limp figure was hauled about halfway up a lamppost. A TV cameraman was recording the whole scene and broadcasting it live. I was thoroughly disgusted by this latter incident and by several others of a similar nature, and I sought out the officer in charge of the troops there to lodge my complaint. I asked him why he wasn't maintaining proper discipline among his men, and I told him in strong terms that the beatings of the prisoners were counterproductive. We must maintain a public image of strength and uncompromising ruthlessness in dealing with the enemies of our race, but to behave like a gang of Ugandans or Puerto Ricans hardly accomplishes that. At this point, there is inserted an editorial note to the reader. Uganda was a political subdivision of the continent of Africa during the old era, when that continent was inhabited by the Negro race. Puerto Rico was the old era name of the island of New Carolina. It is occupied now by the descendants of white refugees from radioactive areas of the southeastern United States. But before the race purges in the final days of the Great Revolution, it was inhabited by a mongrel race of especially unsavory character. Here we return to the main text. Above all else, we must show ourselves as disciplined, since we will be demanding strict discipline on the part of the civilian population. We must never give vent to our feelings of frustration or our personal hatreds, but must show by our behavior at all times that what we are doing is serving a higher purpose. The captain exploded. He shouted at me to mind my own business. When I insisted that I was minding my business, he became red with anger and said that he, not I, was the one who had the responsibility and that he was doing the best he could under very difficult circumstances. He pointed out correctly that the organization had replaced nearly half the men in his company with untrained newcomers in the last month, and so it shouldn't be surprising to me that discipline wasn't all it might be. He also told me that he knew enough about the psychology of his men to understand the value of letting them beat the prisoners as a way of justifying to themselves that the prisoners were their enemies and deserved to be hanged. I really couldn't counter either of the captain's arguments, but I did note with some satisfaction that when he turned away from me, he strode angrily over to a group of soldiers who were brutally pistol-whipping a long-haired, effeminate-looking youth in an outlandishly mod get-up, a popular rock performer, and ordered them to stop. Upon thinking about it, I have come to see things more from the captain's viewpoint. Of course, we must tighten up discipline a great deal as soon as we can. But for the moment, it's better for us to have more political reliability and less discipline among the troops. We delayed our crackdown on the civilian population as long as we did, just so we could weed out and disarm the questionable GIs and replace them with the new people who've been coming through the enemy lines to us. Also, we wanted time to accustom the troops to the new order of things here and to give them at least a little ideological preparation for today's work. And we purposely let the civilians get more out of control than we might have, just so we would have a manifest excuse for taking thoroughly radical measures instead of half measures, which could not have solved the civilian problem in the long run. One other reason for the delay I learned today was that we needed time to finish compiling our arrest lists. For several years, organization members here, just as in other parts of the country, have been building their dossiers of system toadies, Jew fawners, equalitarian theorists, and other white race criminals, along with their street directories of all non-whites residing in predominantly white areas. We were able to use the latter, which were kept quite up to date even during the last month, without modification. But the dossiers required a huge amount of evaluation and weeding. In the first place, there were far too many of them. For example, a white family might have a dossier as race criminals because a neighbor had once observed a black attending a cocktail party at their home, or because they displayed one of the Equality Now bumper stickers, which have been distributed so widely by the human relations councils. In general, unless there was also other evidence in a particular dossier, these people were not put on the arrest list. Otherwise, we'd have had to hang better than 10% of the white population, an entirely impractical task. And even if we could hang that many people, there would be no good reason for it. Most of that 10% are really no worse than most of the other 90%. They have been brainwashed. They are weak and selfish. They have no sense of racial loyalty. But the same things are true of most people these days. People are what they have become, and we have to accept that as a starting point. Actually, it has been true all through history that only small portions of a population are either good or evil. The great bulk are morally neutral, incapable of distinguishing absolute right from absolute wrong, and they take their cue from whoever is on top at the moment. When good men are the rulers and the program makers for a society, The population as a whole will reflect this, and people with no originality or moral sense of direction of their own will nevertheless fervently support the highest aims of their society. But when evil men rule, as has been the case in America for many years now, most of the population will wallow happily in degeneracy of the worst kind, and will self-righteously parrot every filthy and destructive idea that they have been taught. Most judges today, most teachers, actors, civic figures, and so on, are not being consciously and deliberately evil or even cynical in following the lead of the Jews. They think of themselves as being good citizens, just as they would think of themselves if they were acting in a diametrically opposite way under the influence of good leaders. Thus, there is no point in killing them all. This moral weakness will have to be bred out of the race over hundreds of generations. For now, it is sufficient for us to eliminate the consciously evil portion of the population, plus a few hundred thousand of our morally crippled good citizens across the country, as an example to the rest. The hanging of a few of the worst race criminals in every neighborhood in America will help enormously in straightening out the majority of the population and reorienting their thinking. In fact, it will not only help, but it is absolutely necessary. The people require a strong psychological shock to break old habits of thought. I understand all this, yet I must admit that I was troubled by some of the things I witnessed today. When the arrests first started, the public didn't realize what was coming, and many citizens were cocky and abusive. I was present shortly before dawn when the soldiers dragged about a dozen young people out of a large house near one of the university campuses, and they, as well as their housemates who were not arrested, were screaming obscenities at our men and spitting on them. All but one of those arrested here were either Jews, blacks, or mongrels of various sorts, and two of the loudest of them were immediately shot, while the others were herded into a marching column. The last was a white girl, about 19, a bit flabby, but still pretty. The shootings had calmed her down enough so that she was no longer screaming "racist pigs" at the soldiers, but when the preparations for her hanging shortly thereafter awakened her to her own fate, she became hysterical. Informed that she was about to pay the price for defiling her race by living with a black lover, the girl wailed, "But why me?" As the rope was knotted around her neck, she blubbered out, "I was only doing what everyone else was. Why are you picking on me? It's not fair. What about Helen? She was sleeping with him too." At this last outcry, before the girl's breath was cut off forever, one of the other girls, presumably Helen, in the group of now silent spectators on the lawn, shrank back in terror. Of course, no one answered the girl's question, "Why me?" The answer is simply that her name happened to be on our list and Helen's didn't. There's nothing fair about that, or unfair either. The girl who was hanged deserved what she got. Helen probably deserves the same fate, and she is undoubtedly suffering the torments of the damned now, in fear that she eventually will be found out and forced to pay the price her friend did. This little episode has taught me something about political terror. Its very arbitrariness and unpredictability are important aspects of its effectiveness. There are a great many people in Helen's situation whose fear that lightning may strike them at any moment will keep them walking on eggs. The melancholy aspect of the episode is epitomized in the girl's lament, "I was only doing what everyone else was." That's a bit of an exaggeration, but it is true enough that had others not set a bad example for her, the girl probably would not have become a race criminal. She paid as much for the sins of others as for her own. Now I realize more than ever before how essential it is that we instill in all our people a new moral basis, a new set of fundamental values, so that they will no longer be morally adrift like that unfortunate girl was, and like the great majority of Americans today are. This total lack of any healthy or natural morality was brought home to me again just before noon. We were hanging a group of about 40 land developers and real estate brokers outside the offices of the Los Angeles County Fair Housing Association. They had all participated in a special program which made lower mortgage rates available for racially mixed families buying homes in predominantly white neighborhoods. One of the realtors was a sturdy, handsome fellow of about 35 with a blonde crew cut. He was vehemently defending himself. "Hell, I never agreed with any of this race-mixing crap. It makes me sick to my stomach to see these mixed families with their mongrel brats. But a man has to earn a living. I was told by the head building inspector in the county that it would be a lot easier to avoid building code violations for those realtors who went along with the special mortgage program." Without realizing it, he was telling us that a bigger income came before racial loyalty in his set of values, something which is unfortunately true also of a great many who were not hanged today. Well, he made his choice freely, and he hardly deserves any sympathy. The soldiers didn't argue with him, of course. When his turn came, he was jerked off his feet with the same impartiality they had shown toward those who had accepted their fate in silence. They were under orders not to argue with anyone or to explain anything except a brief statement of the offense for which a person was being hanged. Not even the most convincing protestations of innocence or that there must be some mistake caused them to hesitate for an instant. Certainly, we must have made some mistakes today. Mistaken identities, wrong addresses, false accusations. But once the executions began, there was no admitting to the possibility of mistakes. We deliberately created the image of inexorability in the public mind. And apparently, we were quite convincing. Our execution squads were hardly back in their barracks this afternoon when we began receiving reports from all over the city of what appeared to be a sudden wave of murders and beatings. Corpses, most of them showing stab wounds, were being found on sidewalks, in alleys, and in apartment building hallways. A number of injured persons, several hundred altogether, were also picked up on the streets by our patrols. Although there were a few blacks among these beating and stabbing victims, we quickly determined that the great majority of them were Jews. All apparently were persons whom our execution squads had missed, but the citizenry had not. Questioning of several Jews who had been beaten soon revealed that at least some of them had been hiding with Gentile families. After our proclamations were posted, however, their protectors turned on them and drove them into the streets. Local vigilante groups armed with knives and clubs had ferreted out others who had not even been on our lists. I'm sure that without the forceful lesson of this day of the rope, we would not have so quickly elicited this sort of citizen cooperation. The hangings have helped everyone get off the fence in a hurry. Tomorrow afternoon, some of my men will begin organizing civilian labor battalions to cut down the corpses and haul them to the disposal site I have already picked. It'll probably take 3 or 4 days to remove all the bodies. There are between 55 and 60,000 of them. And in this hot weather, it'll be quite unpleasant toward the end. But what a feeling of relief it is to finally have all the negative part of our task here finished. From now on, it's all uphill, in the good sense, reorganizing, re-educating, and rebuilding this whole society. The next diary entry is dated August 8th, 1993. For the last 4 days, I've been acting head of our newly organized Department of Public Resources, Utilities, Services, and Transportation, PRUST, for Southern California. It is a strictly temporary position, and within the next 10 days, I will turn the post over to another engineer, one of the group of volunteers I've been working with during the last 2 weeks. He will have the able assistance of a number of local people who were formerly employed either by one of the state, county, or municipal agencies here, or by one of the private utility companies. And I have confidence he'll be able to iron the remaining bugs out of the department. With more than half the key people back at work here now, things are beginning to run almost normally. We have restored electricity, water, sewage treatment, rubbish collection, and telephone service to all the occupied areas now, although electricity is strictly rationed. We have even put about 50 gasoline stations back in operation, and those civilians whose work assignments give them priority status can obtain fuel for their automobiles. Prust covers our whole enclave, all the way from Vandenberg to the Mexican border, and I've done a lot of traveling to survey the needs and resources of the various areas and to get everything roughly coordinated. I'm really very pleased with what we've been able to accomplish in such a short time. Next to the military and to the Department of Food, Prust has the most essential function to perform and employs the most workers of all the agencies we've set up here. One of the most interesting aspects of my work has been setting up the interfacing with the Department of Food. They produce the food, we transport it, store it, and distribute it. There were several problems to be worked out, primarily because a certain amount of the food which is produced does not go directly from the fields to the distribution points, but is processed first. This means that the Department of Food needs to concern itself to a certain extent with storage and transportation from field to processing plant before Prust takes over the responsibility. Also, the Department of Food has a specialized transportation need in moving its workers from their living quarters to the fields and back. I've had to familiarize myself with the Department of Food's whole operation in order to decide the best way to define our respective responsibilities. I'm very impressed by what I've seen. They have mobilized more than 600,000 workers, about a quarter of the entire productive segment of the population under our control, for the production of food. Between 10% and 15% of these workers are those whites who were formerly in farming or ranching in this area. Nearly a third are young people in the 12 to 18 age range. The rest are people from urban areas who formerly worked in non-essential occupations and have now been assigned to work crews under the Department of Food's supervision. Many in the last group are now doing the first really productive work in their lives. This means the Department of Food is performing an important function of social rehabilitation as well as food production, and our Department of Education is working closely with the Department of Food on this. Every worker receives 10 hours of lectures each week, and he is graded not only on his general attitude toward his work and on his productivity, but also on his responsiveness to these lectures. There is a continual sifting process going on, with workers being reassigned to new work groups on the basis of attitude and performance in their previous groups. In this way, there are already beginning to emerge from the general mass the first leader trainee work groups. From the latter will be selected candidates for organization membership. On several occasions during my tour of the Department of Food's operation, I stopped to talk with workers in the fields. The morale varied considerably from the groups with a high proportion of former social parasites to the leader trainee groups, but nowhere could it be called poor. Everyone has been made to understand that, despite the dislocations and the hardships caused by the revolution, we are now sure that there will be enough food to go around, but those who will not work will not eat either. My most profound impression comes from the fact that every face I saw in the fields was white. No Chicanos, no Orientals, no blacks, no mongrels. The air seems cleaner, the sun brighter, life more joyous. What a wonderful difference this single accomplishment of our revolution has made. And the workers all feel the difference too, whether they are ideologically with us or not. There is a new feeling of solidarity among them, of kinship, of unselfish cooperation to complete a common task. Most of the news reports from other parts of the country are very cheering to us. Although the system is still holding on, it is only doing so through increasingly open and brutal repression. The entire country is under martial law, and the government is relying heavily on hastily armed and deputized black goon squads to keep the white civilian population intimidated. Half the system's regular military units are still confined to their barracks as unreliable. Conditions are deteriorating nearly everywhere. Power outages, transportation and communications breakdowns, terror bombings, food shortages, assassinations, and massive industrial sabotage are plaguing the system and helping to maintain the general unrest. The organization's action units are doing a heroic job, but their losses are heavy. Their only aim now is to maintain the pressure on the system and the general population by striking at every available target again and again and again without letup. From the new volunteers who are slipping into our area through the enemy lines at a growing rate, we get a consistent story about the effect the chaotic conditions are having on people. The white liberals and the minorities are screaming hysterically for the government to do something. The conservatives are moaning, wringing their hands, and deploring the irresponsibility of it all. And the average Joes are becoming more and more exasperated with everyone concerned. Us, the system, the blacks, and the various liberal and conservative spokesmen. They just want a return to normalcy and their accustomed comforts as soon as possible. The system propagandists are making a big thing out of our forced evacuation of non-whites and our summary liquidation of race criminals and other hostile and degenerate elements here. It's not having the desired effect, however, except among the liberals and the minorities. The bulk of the population is too preoccupied with its own problems at the moment to shed a tear for the victims of racism. The biggest fly in our ointment is Northern California. Things are completely out of control there. General Harding has really botched the situation. It serves us right for having anything to do with a conservative. He, like all the rest, was standing behind the door when the brains were passed out, and so he got a double dose of pigheadedness to make up for it. At this point is inserted another editorial note to the reader. Turner is referring to Lieutenant General Arnold Harding, commander of Travis Air Force Base, which was located about halfway between San Francisco and Sacramento. Harding's role in the Great Revolution, though important, lasted only 11 weeks. He was finally assassinated by an organization team on September 16, 1993, after several earlier attempts failed. Here we return to the main text. If the situation in the San Francisco-Sacramento area doesn't improve soon, we're likely to be involved in a civil war against the troops under Harding. The system would really love that. The only thing Harding has done right so far was breaking with Washington during the first week of our July 4th offensive, as soon as it became clear that the system had lost its grip in California. On his own initiative, he declared an independent military government in Northern California and got nearly all the other officers in military units stationed there, except our own undercover military people, of course, to go along with him. Revolutionary Command made the strictly practical decision to let General Harding carry the ball in his area, and our people were instructed not to oppose him. This had the effect of substantially reducing our own losses, although the military has actually suffered many more casualties in Northern California than in the South. This is because Harding has failed to take sufficiently radical measures to consolidate his authority and to deal with black military personnel. And he has failed utterly to get the civilian population under control, again because he seems unable to understand the necessity for radical measures. The Jews and the other Bolshevik elements in San Francisco are running circles around him, and the Chicanos in the Sacramento area have been rioting more or less continuously for a month. When a delegation of organization people went to Harding last month and suggested a joint organization-military rule for Northern California, with Harding's forces handling defense matters and the organization handling civilian matters, including police functions, Harding arrested them and has refused to release them. Since then, he has been issuing idiotic proclamations about restoring the Constitution, stamping out communism and pornography, and holding new elections to reestablish the Republican form of government intended by the Founding Fathers, whatever that means. And he has denounced our radical measures in the South as communism. He is appalled that we didn't hold some sort of public referendum before expelling the non-whites, and that we didn't give individual trials to the Jews and race criminals we dealt with summarily. Doesn't the old fool understand that the American people voted themselves into the mess they're in now? Doesn't he understand that the Jews have taken over the country fair and square according to the Constitution? Doesn't he understand that the common people have already had their fling at self-government, and they blew it? Where does he think new elections can possibly lead now with this generation of TV-conditioned voters, except right back into the same Jewish pigsty? And how does he think we could have solved our problems down here, except by the radical measures we used? Doesn't Harding understand that the chaos in his area will continue to grow worse until he identifies the categories of people responsible for that chaos and deals with them categorically? That it is physically impossible, considering the relative numbers involved, for him to deal with the Jews, the blacks, the Chicanos, and the other troublesome elements on an individual basis? Apparently not, because the idiot is still making appeals to responsible black leaders and to patriotic Jews to help him restore order. Harding, like conservatives in general, can't bring himself to do what must be done, because it would mean punishing the innocent along with the guilty, the good Negroes and the loyal Jews along with the rest, as if those terms had any meaning in the present context. And so, afraid of treating individuals unjustly, he is floundering around helplessly while everything goes to hell and the civilians in his area die like flies from starvation. Generals should be made of sterner stuff. The one advantage to us from the situation in the North is the flood of white refugees it has brought us. More people have been coming into our area in the last 2 weeks to get away from the anarchy around San Francisco than have been slipping through the system's lines from the rest of the country. And while they last, it is interesting to have living, breathing examples of three types of social orders simultaneously before us. In the North, a conservative regime. To the East, liberal Jewish democracy. And here, the beginning of a whole new world rising out of the ruins of the old. The next diary entry is dated August 23rd. Tomorrow I leave for Washington again. I have been at Vandenberg for 4 days, learning how nuclear warheads work. I am in charge of a group which will hand carry 4 60-kiloton warheads to Washington for concealment in key locations around the Capitol. Approximately 50 other men, all members of the order, were trained with me, and each of them has a similar mission as a group leader. That means a total of about 200 warheads to be dispersed around the country initially, with more to follow later. All the warheads are identical. They were removed from a stockpile of 240-millimeter artillery projectiles our people found here. They've been slightly modified so they can be detonated by coded radio signals. They will be our insurance in case we lose our missile launch facility here. The present mission is the hairiest one I've ever been assigned. It will be a lot tougher than blowing up the FBI headquarters 2 years ago. 5 of us must make our way through 3,500 miles of enemy territory, carrying 4 nuclear bombs weighing a total of just over 520 pounds without getting caught. Then we have to sneak them into areas that will be heavily guarded and conceal them so that there is a negligible chance of their being found. Aside from the dangers involved, which tie my guts in knots whenever I think about them, I have mixed feelings about this mission. On the one hand, I hate to leave California. Being a participant in the birth of our new society here has been tremendously exciting and rewarding for me, and our work is just beginning. New projects are being launched every day, and I want to be a part of them. We are laying the foundations here for the new social order which will serve our race for the next 1,000 years. And to be able to live and work in a sane, healthy white man's world, that is something which is beyond valuation for me. These last few weeks have been wonderful. It is terribly depressing to think of leaving this white oasis and plunging once again into that cesspool of mongrels and blacks and Jews and sick, twisted white liberals out there. On the other hand, it has been more than 3 months since I've seen Catherine, and it seems like a year. The one thing which has limited my enthusiasm about what we've accomplished here is that she hasn't been able to share it with me. And now, with the changed situation, she and the others in Washington are living under much more difficult conditions and in greater danger than we here in California. Realizing that makes me feel guilty every day I remain. The strongest feeling I have now, however, is one of responsibility. I am both proud and awed that I, still only a probationary member of the order, am being entrusted with such an important and difficult task. I must try hard to put all other thoughts and feelings aside until it is successfully completed. During the last 4 days, I have not only learned about the structure and functioning of the warheads for which I will be responsible, but also why this mission is vital. That involved a lesson in strategy which has been very sobering. The people in Revolutionary Command, with their eyes fixed firmly on our long-range goal of total victory over the system, have not let themselves be deluded by our gains in California and the present difficulties the system is facing elsewhere. The grim facts are these. First, outside of California, the system remains essentially intact, and the disparity in numbers between the system's forces and our own is even worse than it was before July 4th. That's because we've been recklessly expending our strength everywhere else in the country to keep the system off balance long enough for us to consolidate our gains here. Second, despite the military forces under our control here, the system, as soon as it has tidied up some of its present military morale problems, will be able to pound us into the ground by conventional means with very little trouble. The only thing that's really kept them off us this long has been our threat of nuclear reprisal against New York and Tel Aviv. Third, our nuclear threat is in grave danger of being neutralized. The system has the capability for launching a surprise first strike against us with a high probability of knocking out all our hardened launch silos before we can fire our missiles. Revolutionary Command's intelligence sources indicate that such a surprise strike is exactly what is being planned. The system is holding off only until it has finished an emergency military reorganization, which will give it confidence in the political reliability of the U.S. Army. It wants to follow up its destruction of our nuclear capability immediately with a massive invasion which will finish us off in a day or two. Worse, the system has an alternative plan which calls for the nuclear annihilation of all of Southern California. It will carry out that plan if it fails to regain complete confidence in the reliability of its military ground forces within the next couple of weeks. We still don't know the system's exact timetable, but we have reports that more than 25,000 of the wealthiest and most influential Jews and their families have quietly packed up and left the New York area within the last 10 days, most of them taking only a moderate amount of luggage with them, perhaps enough for a 2 or 3 week vacation. Thus, our entire strategy against the system has been undermined. If we could hold the enemy off indefinitely, or even for a year or two, with our threat of nuclear retaliation, then we could pull him down. With California as a training and supply base, and with a population of more than 5 million whites to recruit from, we could steadily escalate our guerrilla war throughout the rest of the country. But without California, we can't do it, and the system knows that. So what we must do immediately is to disperse a large number of nuclear weapons outside California. We will then detonate at least one of those weapons to convince the system that a new situation exists. If the system attacks California after that, we will be obligated to detonate all or most of our dispersed weapons in an effort to destroy the system's capability for organized resistance. Unfortunately, much of the white population of the country is bound to be lost if we are forced to that extremity. The country will also be open to the danger of invasion by other nations, a grim prospect indeed. The next diary entry is dated September 4th, 1993. Although I've been in Washington nearly a week now, this is the first opportunity I've had to write. After our hectic trip across the country, we spent several hectic days getting two of our bombs planted. Then last night was the first uninterrupted night I've had alone with Catherine since I've been back. And tomorrow it's another bomb-planting mission. But tonight is for writing. Our trip here from California was like something from a zany movie. Even though all the events are still fresh in my mind, I can hardly believe they really happened. Conditions in this country have changed so much in the last 9 weeks that it's as if we had used a time machine to step into an entirely different era. An era in which all the old rules for coping we spent a lifetime learning have been changed. Fortunately for us, everyone else seems just as bewildered by the changes as we are. I was surprised at the ease with which we were able to leave our enclave. The system's troops are all clumped together in just a few border areas along the major highways, with additional company-sized groups stationed at roadblocks on the back roads. These back road troops are doing practically no patrolling, and it is a simple and safe matter to bypass them, which accounts for the fact that so many white volunteers have been able to infiltrate into our area of California since July 4th. We took an army truck north to Bakersfield, and then drove northeast another 20 miles to within half a mile of a roadblock manned by black troops. We could see them, and they could see us, but they didn't try to give us any trouble as we pulled off the main road onto a rough Forest Service trail. We were already in the foothills of the Sierra Range. After about an hour of bouncing over the steep, barely passable mountain road, we pulled back onto the highway again, safely beyond the roadblock, but now deep into system-controlled territory. We weren't especially concerned about running into any opposition in the mountains. We knew the largest concentration of system troops was at China Lake on the other side of the Sierras, and we intended to turn north along Highway 395 before then. Our plan, had we met a supply truck heading for the roadblock back near Bakersfield, was simply to blast it off the narrow mountain highway before its occupants realized we were the enemy. All five of us kept our automatic rifles cocked and ready, and we had two rocket launchers besides, but we met no other vehicles. We knew that, despite the unnatural absence of traffic in the mountains, we would certainly encounter heavy traffic when we reached 395, the main north-south highway east of the mountains. Our reconnaissance patrols hadn't been able to give us anything but a very generalized picture of troop dispositions that far east, and we had no idea what to expect in the way of roadblocks or other controls on vehicular traffic. We did know that fewer than 10% of the system troops in the border area at that time were whites, however. The system was gradually regaining confidence in some of its white troops, but it was still avoiding using them near the border, where they might be tempted to come over to our side. The few white military personnel in the area, even though confirmed race mixers, were regarded with suspicion and treated with the contempt they deserved by the blacks. Our spies had reported several instances in which these white renegades had been humiliated and abused by their black fellow soldiers. Considering this, we had decided that we would have a better chance as non-whites of bluffing our way past any challengers. Accordingly, we had all applied a dark stain to our faces and hands and pinned Chicano-sounding name tags on our fatigue uniforms. We figured we could pass as mestizos, so long as we didn't run into any real Chicanos. For 4 days, I was Jesus Garcia. Our driver, Corporal Rodriguez, played his role to the hilt, giving a left-handed clenched fist salute and flashing a toothy grin whenever we passed an idle group of black soldiers along the highway, and on the two occasions we were stopped at checkpoints. We also kept a transistor radio tuned to a Mexican station, blaring soulful Chicano music whenever we were within earshot of system troops. Once, when we needed to refuel, we were briefly tempted to pull in at a military gasoline depot. But the long line of waiting trucks and the groups of blacks lounging about made us decide against the risk. We stopped instead at a roadside restaurant curio shop filling station in the shadow of Mount Whitney. The place seemed deserted, so two of our men began filling our fuel tank at the gasoline pump, while I and the others headed for the restaurant to see if we could find any food to take along. We found four soldiers inside, quite drunk, sitting around a table cluttered with empty bottles and glasses. Three were blacks, and the fourth was white. "Anybody around here we can pay for gas and some food?" I asked. "No, man, just take what you want. We ran the honky owners out of here 3 days ago," one of the blacks responded. "But not before we had some real fun with their daughter, eh?" the white exclaimed, grinning and nudging one of his companions. Perhaps it was the grim stare I gave him, or perhaps he suddenly noticed Corporal Rodriguez's very blue eyes, or it may have been that the stain on our faces had become too streaked from perspiration. In any event, the white soldier suddenly stopped grinning and whispered something to the blacks. At the same time, he leaned back and reached for his rifle, which was resting against an adjacent table. Before he even touched his weapon, I pivoted my M16 off my shoulder and raked the group at the table with a blast of fire, which sent them all sprawling to the floor, spurting blood. The three blacks were quite obviously dead, but their white renegade companion, though shot through the chest, raised himself to a sitting position and asked in a plaintive voice, "Hey, man, what the shit?" Corporal Rodriguez finished him off. He pulled his bayonet from his belt scabbard, seized the dying white by his hair, and hauled him off the floor, the point of the bayonet jammed under his chin. "You piece of race-mixing filth, go join your black brothers." And with one savage stroke, Rodriguez practically decapitated him. 5 miles further down the highway, at the intersection where we wanted to turn east, a military police jeep with two blacks in it was blocking the side road. A third black was directing traffic, waving all northbound military vehicles on down the main highway. We ignored his signals and turned right, going far out on the shoulder to get around the jeep. The black traffic controller blew his whistle furiously, and all three MPs gesticulated and waved their arms wildly at us. But our Corporal Rodriguez just grinned and gave his black power salute, shouted, "Siesta frijoli, hasta la vista," and a few other Spanish words which came into his head, pointed meaningfully down the road ahead, and stepped on the accelerator. We left the blacks in a shower of dust and gravel. The black with the whistle was still tooting and waving his arms as we went around the bend, and that was the last we saw of him. Apparently, he and his companions did not think it worthwhile trying to follow us, but our three men hidden in the back of the truck kept their fingers on the triggers of their automatic rifles, just in case. From there until we got to the outskirts of St. Louis, we didn't run into any more concentrations of system troops. But we accomplished that only by avoiding the major highways and cities and sticking to secondary roads. We rattled and bounced across the mountains and deserts of California, Nevada, Utah, and Colorado, and then the plains of Kansas and the rolling hills of Missouri for 75 hours straight, stopping only to refuel and relieve ourselves. While two of us rode in front, and a third kept watch out the back of the truck, two of us at a time tried to sleep, but without much success. When we reached eastern Missouri, we changed our tactics for two reasons. First, we heard the radio broadcast of the bombing of Miami and Charleston and the organization's ultimatum to the system. That made the time factor even more important than before. We couldn't afford any further delays from circuitous routes along back roads. Second, the danger of our being stopped by the authorities between St. Louis and Washington decreased sharply as all hell broke loose in the country, giving us the opportunity to adopt a new ploy. We had been monitoring both the civilian broadcast band and the military communications bands during the trip, and we were about 80 miles west of St. Louis when a special announcer cut into the afternoon weather report. The previous day, at noon, a nuclear bomb had been detonated without warning in Miami Beach, the announcer said, killing an estimated 60,000 people and causing enormous damage. A second nuclear bomb had been detonated outside Charleston, South Carolina, just 4 hours ago, but casualty and damage reports were not yet available. Both bombings were the work of the organization, said the announcer, and he would now read the text of an organization ultimatum. I jotted down the ultimatum almost word for word on a scrap of paper as it came over the truck radio, and this is very nearly it. To the President and the Congress of the United States and the commanders of all U.S. armed forces, we, the Revolutionary Command of the organization, issue the following demands and warning. First, cease immediately all buildup of military forces in Eastern California and adjacent areas, and abandon all plans for an invasion of the liberated zone of California. Second, abandon all plans for a nuclear strike against the liberated zone of California or any portion of it. Third, make known to the people of the United States, through all the communications channels at your disposal, these demands and this warning. If you have failed to comply with any of our three demands by noon tomorrow, August 27th, we will detonate a second nuclear device in some population center of the United States, just as we detonated one in the Miami, Florida area a few minutes ago. We will continue to detonate one nuclear device every 12 hours thereafter until you have complied. We furthermore warn you that if you make any surprise, hostile move against the liberated zone of California, we will immediately detonate more than 500 nuclear devices, which have already been hidden in key target areas throughout the United States. More than 40 of these devices are now located in the New York City area. In addition, we will immediately use all the nuclear missiles still available to us to destroy the Jewish presence in Palestine. Finally, we warn you that, in any event, we intend to liberate first the entire United States and then the remainder of this planet. When we have done so, we will liquidate all the enemies of our people, including, in particular, all white persons who have consciously aided those enemies. We are aware now, and we will continue to be aware, of your most confidential plans and of every order you receive from your Jewish masters. Abandon your race treason now, or abandon all hope for yourselves when you fall into the hands of the people you have betrayed. At this point is inserted an editorial note to the reader. Turner's version of the organization's ultimatum is essentially correct, except for a few minor errors in wording and his omission of one sentence from the next-to-last paragraph. The full and exact text of the ultimatum is in Chapter 9 of Professor Anderson's definitive History of the Great Revolution. Here, Earl Turner's text resumes. We had pulled off the road when the special announcer came on, and it took us a few minutes to gather our thoughts and decide what to do. We had not really expected things to develop so rapidly. Those fellows who took the warheads to Miami and Charleston must have either left a day or two ahead of us, or they must have really been burning up the highways to get there so soon. Despite our non-stop driving, we felt like a bunch of shirkers. We knew the fat was really in the fire. We were in the middle of a nuclear civil war, and within the next few days, the fate of the planet would be decided for all time. Now it was either the Jews or the white race, and everyone knew the game was for keeps. I still haven't figured out all the details of our strategy leading up to the ultimatum. I don't know why, for example, Miami and Charleston were chosen as initial targets, although I've heard a rumor that the rich Jews who were evacuated from New York were being temporarily housed in the Charleston area, and Miami, of course, already had a superabundance of Jews. But why not take out the New York City area instead, with its 2.5 megakikes? Perhaps our bombs weren't really in place yet in New York, despite what our ultimatum said. And I'm also not sure why our ultimatum took the particular form it did, all stick and no carrot. Perhaps it was deliberately intended to stampede the cattle, which indeed it has. Or perhaps there were some under-the-table communications between Revolutionary Command and the system's military leaders which determined the form of the ultimatum. In any event, it has had the effect of splitting the system right down the middle. The Jews and nearly all the politicians are in one faction, and nearly all the military leaders are in another faction. The Jewish faction is demanding the immediate nuclear annihilation of California, regardless of the consequences. The accursed Goyim have raised their hands against the chosen people and must be destroyed at any cost. The military faction, on the other hand, is in favor of a temporary truce while an effort is made to find our 500, a forgivable exaggeration, nuclear devices, and disarm them. After hearing that broadcast, our only thought was to get our deadly cargo to Washington as soon as possible. We knew everyone would be off balance for a while as a result of what had just happened, and we decided to take advantage of the general confusion by converting our truck into an emergency vehicle and barreling straight down the highway toward our destination. We didn't have a siren, but we did have flashing red lights front and rear, and we completed the conversion a few minutes later by stopping in a rural hardware store and buying some cans of spray paint, which, with some hastily improvised stencils made from torn newspapers, we used to paint Red Cross symbols in the appropriate places on our truck. After that, we made Washington in less than 20 hours, despite the chaotic conditions on the highways. We sped along shoulders to get past stalled traffic, drove on the wrong side of the road with horn blaring and lights flashing, bounced over culverts and open fields to get around blocked intersections, and generally ignored all traffic controllers, bluffing our way through more than a dozen checkpoints. Our first bomb went into Fort Belvoir, the big army base just south of Washington, where I was locked up for more than a year. We had to wait 2 maddening days to make contact with our inside man there, so we could arrange to get the bomb inside the base and hidden in the right area. Rodriguez went over the fence with the bomb strapped on his back. I received a radio signal from him the next day, confirming the successful completion of his mission. Meanwhile, the rest of us planted a second bomb in the District of Columbia, where it will be able to take out a couple of 100,000 blacks when it goes, not to mention a few government agencies, and a critical portion of the Capitol's transportation network. I didn't have my final orders on the third bomb until this afternoon. That will go into the Silver Spring area north of here, the center of the Maryland suburban Jewish community. The fourth one is intended for the Pentagon, but security is so tight there, I still haven't figured a way to get it anywhere near the place. I must confess that my mind has not been entirely on my work since I've been back here. Catherine and I have stolen time from our organization responsibilities to be together. Neither of us had realized how much we have come to mean to each other until we were separated again this summer, so soon after my escape from prison. In the month we were together this spring, before I was sent to Texas, and then to Colorado, and finally to California, we became as close as any two people can possibly be. Things have been hard for Catherine and the others here while I was gone, especially since July 4th. They have been under enormous pressure from two directions. The organization has been pushing them without mercy to continually step up their level of activism, while the danger of being caught by the political police has grown worse every week. The system is resorting to new methods in its fight against us. massive house-to-house searches of multi-block areas, astronomical rewards for informers, much tighter controls on all civilian movement. In many other parts of the country, these repressive measures have been more sporadic,